What kind of a tourist do you think you are?
Oh, that's a good question. Because, of course, we all want to say we're not really tourists. We're, kind of travelers and sojourners, and those other people with the shopping bags and whatnot are the tourists. But I'm a pretty unabashed tourist. And what kind am I? I try to be sort of invisible. I like that feeling of being lost in a crowd and having really an anonymous face. I don't know why I like that. It just gives me a great feeling of solitude that I have not so much when I'm just all alone.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Megan McNamer about her novel, Home Everywhere. Don't go away.
Home Everywhere follows a group of confused tourists visiting an unnamed country in Asia and tells how they got there and where they think they're going. The book is a suitcase full of souvenirs scavenged from lives liberated briefly from the cares of the world. Megan, at one point, one of your characters says, "All journeys start with an anxious pang of doubt. You suddenly feel an orphan." And I wanted to ask you, how did the book come to be? And when you began the book, did you feel that anxious pang of doubt?
Well, truth to be told, not really. I always feel a real exciting jolt of just a thrill when I'm taking off on a trip. I kind of think we're all confused tourists as human beings, and we're sort of born homesick. And we do a rather amazing job of constructing worlds to live in, whether it's how we run countries or how we park our cars, and kind of accepting that as a norm. And what I love about travel is suddenly your normal is the exotic, and you get that sense by traveling elsewhere and seeing they don't do things the same in Cairo or Kalamazoo, for that matter. And when you return, you suddenly see your own life as this arbitrary, really assortment of priorities and details. And I just love that.
How did you come up with the characters and the places for the book?
Well, some of these characters I'd been keeping company with before I wrote this book, and then I didn't know what to do with them. They were hanging around and in my drawers, and then I went on this trip. I actually went on a trip to a named Asian country. It was Thailand with my aunt and uncle, and it was a name tag guided tour, and the whole thing was just a total lark. It was totally fun. And I just felt a great kind of love for this group of people because they were so willing to do what really objectively is a very outrageous thing to, shoot yourself through the ozone at many hundreds of thousands of miles of speed, whatever it is. And this was in right before 9/11. And so of course, terrible things have been happening on the earth since it was populated by humans. But that sense of planes disappearing over the Indian Ocean or things changing on a dime one morning, for me, were not quite real. I'd heard all about them of World War II. Vietnam was a long slog. So that sense of, I think somewhere in the book, there's a phrase of a gazillion shoes ready to drop. And I felt that, and I always feel that when I travel. And you sort of fall into a sleepy mode in your daily life. And it excites me and makes me love other people more to get up close to it through travel.
There's a character in your book, Irene, who begins taking notes for an article. And she jots down the phrase, "I like to be going somewhere more than being anywhere," as well as, "I'd rather be in transit than in paradise." How are you similar or different to Irene?
It's funny that you ask that, because I see Irene as a very lonely, socially awkward person, maybe with a drinking problem, and just kind of the odd person you don't really want to sit next to on the plane. And everyone has said to me, "You're Irene, right?" So I'm a little disconcerted by that, but not really. I realize I gave Irene a whole bunch of my own life, and I probably am more like Irene than I want to admit. But that going somewhere, but I've always been uncomfortable with travel writing in terms of, now I'm going to tell you all about this place that I'm such an authority about on. And so I tried to dislodge it from that. But actually, that piece I wanted to pitch to Islands magazine, so I had to get to an island. And I was in Bangkok. So I ditched the Unitarians. I told my aunt I was going to try to do this, and I just took off to go to an island and just went from point A to point B to point C till I was finally on an island. And then I had to get back that same day. And the whole thing felt so arbitrary that it made my mind dislodge a little bit from the point on the map. And I felt more like I was free floating a little above the earth. And anyway, the going was the whole point of that day. I spent maybe 15 minutes on the island, and then I turned right around and had to get back by ferry, which almost sank, by bus, by tuk-tuk. And that's a whole story that didn't even make it in there. It was like a 4-hour tuk-tuk ride that, because I didn't know the name of my hotel. So it was a classic lesson in just being lost in the world for a day.
I think it's necessary to tell listeners what a tuk-tuk is, because a 4-hour journey on a tuk-tuk is a big deal.
It's a motorcycle taxi. So you're sitting in the back. It's like a rickshaw with a motor.
It's funny because I found myself reading some of your Salon articles, including one that you wrote called Travel by the Book.
Yeah.
And you write a statement, "Guidebooks were fine for lists, but they forgot drama," which yeah. It sounds like what you had just mentioned. And I want to know, what is your relationship to the guidebook?
Well, you know, I like to loudly proclaim that I don't like guidebooks. But of course, you usually have one in your possession if you're traveling. And I kind of look at it out of the corner of my eye. I find them very disheartening in that, you know, you'll be with some people maybe, and you're in a foreign land, and everywhere you look is something interesting and exciting. But they're fixated on this certain pottery shop in the guidebook or a certain restaurant that's probably exactly like the one next to it. And they're unfulfilled until they've landed. I do think it's not a horrible human impulse. It's a way of connecting. I found it. I somehow am connected to the person who wrote the guidebook, maybe. It's not a horrible trait. It's just one I don't like, because I love serendipity and I love wandering and I like cast off things. And for me, travel is really all about, I mean, I get my influences from things that are not about travel at all, but it's a lot of how you engage with the normal or the familiar. And the really wonderful thing is to find the normal in these tucked away places, the so-called normal, and suddenly it seems very rich and interesting. And then you realize that your own normal is that. And you start looking at your own just familiar details of life with these new eyes. And so guidebooks to me kind of tamp that impulse down. That's all.
I want to dig into one of the couples in your book that are on this tour, beginning with a chapter called Revisioning the Other Aspects, Mr. and Mrs. Small. Will you first begin by describing this couple?
This couple? Well, of course, I've robbed my own life for this couple. it started off as a essay, this whole section. And, well, my husband and I went to Hawaii. I was studying at the university ethnomusicology. I was, again, rationalizing this very, very practical thing to do. And he was kind of lost because he had quit his job so we could do this. And he had applied to law schools, hadn't yet heard. So it was kind of a unmoored time for him. I was just zinging. I just loved the study of ethnomusicology. And so I kind of took us then and I heightened it and made us goofier. And I flipped the gender. So I was Mistress Small and my husband was Mrs. Small. But Mrs. Small then turned into this whole other kind of badass character. And I really kind of like her. Oh, I like him too. But she had a little more assertive, critical role than he really ever did. But it was that sense of a couple out of their milieu and trying to make sense of it all. And then realizing, you know, Mr. Small, I had him rich, which I never have been, and just kind of got set up in a life. But always carrying around that feeling of having let something go that was his big passion, and now morphing into a genial older man who goes to elder hostels. But Queen Liliuokalani is always sort of wafting around in his brain. Again, that sense of a great wistfulness for all you will never know, all you can never experience, because the world's too big and you won't. And so he kind of embodies that for me.
Who is this queen?
Queen Liliuokalani. She was a queen of the Hawaiians. All these different countries were carving up her beloved Hawaii like it was a banana coconut cream pie with nuts. They were the nuts. But Hawaii was just being parsed out into big pineapple plantations. And the Hawaiians have had a royalty system, and the early kings and queens made it a very solid government for these imperialists to deal with. So, you know, they would go to Washington and stuff. But there was sort of a coup of that system, and she was imprisoned in her summer palace for a period of time to be really robbed of her power. And that was the end of royalty as a force to be reckoned with in Hawaii.
You know, what was interesting to me about this couple is that they grapple openly with a sense of belonging and globalism. And about cultural domination, you write, "The problem of cultural domination had remained on their marital radar, and, of course, it was a problem for the world in general." And so I want to see if you can even deepen the conversation around why have Mr. and Miss Small hold this part of the book about globalism and travel and colonialism and cultural domination?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because they're pretty complacent. They have their nice life in Seattle. They have their nanny for their rebellious little girls and who drive Maseratis or something. I don't know what they drive, Sobs. We were there in the early 80s in Hawaii, and all that was sort of starting to come to all of our minds, I believe. And that's when I was studying ethnomusicology. I went on and studied at the University of Washington, and I always felt like I was playing intellectual catch-up with this understanding of what was happening to the world. And I felt very rebellious at this sense that things were dying culturally and that it was cultural gray out was still an expression that would be used in anthropology and ethnomusicology then. I don't think it is now. And I've been so away, so I hesitate to say. But that sense of a world being just consumed by its own modernization seemed very much like what the Hawaiians had experienced, what Native Americans had experienced, what just subjugated people the world over experience over and over. Just, it's, you know, there's real death, which is horrible, but there's also just this flattening out of their vivid world that they thought was flattenable. And we realize we all are natives in that sense, and it could happen to us. So
why have them?
Oh, why have them? So just the scholarly background, the ologies, anthropology, ethnomusicology, the attempt to grapple with these questions, but getting to go back to your comfortable upper middle class life and grapple with them at your leisure seem to be exemplified by Mr. and Mrs. Small. And it's also a tourist question because, you know, we drop in, take a lot of photos, and realize how extremely incredible this reality is someone else's reality. But now our plane's leaving and we pop back out again and often claim then to know all about it. Plus, I wanted to give them a kind of lightheartedness as well, because I didn't want to get heavy about that topic and heavy-handed. It just is. It's not, I didn't want to be blaming any of us in a way. So that's why I also made them mortally vulnerable. They both grappled with cancer, and it's in a sense saying we're all, no matter how much we delude ourselves, this is all about mortality. What we're doing here on the earth. We're going somewhere.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Megan McNamer about her novel, Home Everywhere. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
Will you read a bit from that chapter?
Yeah, I'd love to. Maybe once every 5 or 10 years, maybe late at night when a warm June rain beyond the open window reminded him of Queen Liliuokalani alone in her summer palace, Mr. Small thought of those days when he and Mrs. Small had lived in emergent love and tremulous hope on the island of Oahu. Or he might remember that time in Hawaii while ordering teas from India, Sumatra, China, and all over, watching the occasional table of students relaxing after a tour of the Seattle Art Museum, students who reminded him of his own younger self, studying in the tea room of Honolulu's Bishop Museum, sifting through his notes from the lectures, trying to catch hold of something, be carried away. Mr. Small had thought that if he could just manage to cast himself out into the world, far beyond the confines and expectations of Massachusetts, he automatically would have easy access to knowledge previously unattained. But Mr. Small had found that he was mostly the same person in Hawaii as in Massachusetts, that his propensity toward resolution was stronger than his urge toward discovery, and that, like the wheat grower from Washington State on the flight down, who beat back fear with miscellaneous information, his life now was full of details, pleasant, sad, ordinary, and strange, that served to diffuse and obscure the lacunae in his thought and the longing in his heart. In other words, he never really did get a grip on verbal and nonverbal categories, indigenous expression, and ways of knowing. The concept of place had resisted revisioning. He passed that mission on to others. Sometimes he thought about these others. He imagined them scattered all across the world, in a soft mist, on the edge of a volcano, in lecture halls and at podiums, on the black sand beaches by the sea, a great diaspora of inquiry, articulation, and yearning. And sometimes he thought about that alien bamboo in the university courtyard, speaking softly to itself.
All right, I'm going to go two more places and then we'll wind down. Megan, I was thinking about the style of writing because there is a vagueness to it and there's also this incredible specificity. Sometimes it felt like I was watching contrails fade. For instance, you write in depth about travel clothing, which I thought was really funny. And you talk about a character named Keith and his zip-off pants. And in one passage you write, Keith reported that his pants were still breathing. This was a footnote to an ongoing discussion about silk. Could you wash it? Throw it in a duffel? Was it durable as the new microfibers? As cool? As cheap? And so I had this sense of travel clothing as a metaphor for something. And I want to know if you can piece that together for me.
Well, it's strange you ask that because I was just thinking that this morning. For me, it sort of entertains me a lot to think about it. And I one time tried to write a fake catalog of travel clothing using only language from Levi Strauss's Tristro Peaks, because he talks a lot about rain and mildew and comfort in that book, strangely enough, but making fun of anthropology and ethnomusicology and all the scholarly jargon that goes into that when talking about quote-unquote material culture. That kind of was the entertain myself part of it. But really, I think the fixation on clothes is sort of linked to my feeling about travel as ritual and having a lot of the components of ritual. So you, in another piece I wrote, I think for Islands, you know, I equated it to theater, that travel is like theater and theater is its own kind of trip. There's a beginning, a middle, an end, the lights go off, the curtain opens. There's that sense of a very highlighted moment in time and space. The ritual part, so we put on these special vestments. We all do when we travel. And really, that's a lot of what people are thinking about. I don't care who they are. I bet you Marco Polo worried about his shoes. Are they going to be the right ones? And the stuff you bring. And I think we all set off, especially if it's an international trip, but even driving to Billings, yes, there are stores there, but you want to be equipped. And it's some human impulse that I think is liberating because you are suddenly dislodging yourself from your daily needs, but you still have your needs. But so you have them all in a little bundle. And it makes you feel kind of free and yet secure. And so I love to think about travel clothes and what we think we need. It's so funny.
Your book came to me at a time when I was reading the Polish sociologist and philosopher Zygmunt Bauman, and he writes about the evolution of the tourist. And I want to read you this quote and then pair it with a quote from yours. He says, "The tourist wants to immerse themselves in a strange and bizarre element, a pleasant feeling, a tickling and rejuvenating feeling, like letting oneself be buffeted by sea waves, on condition, though, that it will not stick to their skin and thus can be shaken off whenever they wish." And you write, everyone wanted to see the real city, provided there were no bedbugs, thin walls, illicit activities, people sleeping in the corridors, bathrooms out back, junkies, whoremongers, cheerless lonely people, people in traffic from the disco bars, or hookers renting long-term rooms for short-term use. So circling all the way back around, what are we looking for when we're tourists? What are we hoping to shake off? What are we trying to resist and what are we trying to integrate?
Oh boy, that's a huge question. What is it we are trying to seek and gain and what is it we're trying to avoid? Daily life is troubling. We are all crafting these personas, and no matter what age we're at, that give us a lot of trouble. And what are our hopes? What are our dreams? What have we accomplished? Will we ever accomplish them? Who are our friends? What did they do? Was that right? On and on. And sometimes it just gets to be a bit much. And so you just want to flee, on the one hand. I think fleeing is a big impulse for travel. But I think a lot of people are frightened of the unknown, and I don't blame them. And I don't quite feel that way about myself. I feel like I'm not frightened of the unknown. I haven't traveled that much. So it's still very exhilarating. And nothing very bad has ever happened to me. So I think I have a sense of security in it. But a lot of people, they have completely different histories. And so I think they want that liberation, and yet they're afraid of it at the same time. And I think that's where the homesickness comes in. You want to spend the night with your friend at age 7, and you're just dying 1,000 deaths all night long. You miss your home so much. And I think that kind of conflict is really at the heart of a lot of travel. The kind of sad thing that happens is where people get too comfortable with it. They go with masses of friends, and they have a lot of money, and they make sure they have kind of maximize their time and get their dollars worth of all. And it's like shopping at, you know, a high-end department store instead of going to the thrift shop. And I'm very much a thrift shop person. So that what will you find? What strange thing completely out of context is what, for me, what is the thrill? Other than that, I don't expect to be a different person or to be redeemed. I think we do kind of want to be redeemed. We want to be redeemed from our mortality. And that sounds very Catholic, and I was raised Catholic, but where, you know, you hit a certain age as a child and you're suddenly, wait, what? We're all going to die. And everyone's walking around like this is perfectly normal. And I think then the rest of your life, you're trying to make sense of that. And I think it's the impulse for a lot of art, all art perhaps. And I think there's a huge component of that in travel, because you have set when you're going to quote unquote die at the end of the trip. You have created a little life inside your life. And you can just live in that life and not think about the larger parameters.
Megan McNamer lives in Missoula, Montana. Her first novel, Children and Lunatics, won the Big Moose Prize. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.